corporate act, yeah. And you must dispense and so forth. And it is only on his order that the troops open fire, other than in absolute self-defense. Yeah. In other words, if somebody is shooting at them or they are under attack, then they can respond by shooting. But shooting is the very last act to fall back on. And every other form of coercion, force, is to be used before shooting takes place. And this is why, in that kind of a confrontation, you need extremely well-trained and disciplined troops. We have the case of down at Kent University, where you had the National Guard, who were not the most highly trained troops in the world. And I would venture to say that if they had been extremely well-trained and disciplined, that shooting would never have taken place. A little bit of panic, and a little bit of panic, and it only takes one person to shoot. And here again, if you've got extremely well-trained people, as a matter of fact, the boys were not even allowed to keep a bullet up the spout. It was hammered into them. Every time they went out on patrol, they were inspected. Their weapons were inspected. Do you have a bullet up the spout? And for the very simple reason, we didn't want anybody to fire a shot accidentally. But for whatever reason, and in that tense atmosphere, someone could have fired a shot a block away, and God, heaven knows how many other people would have immediately started to shoot at ghosts. It was tense, terribly, terribly, terribly tense. So every precaution was taken by the military to ensure that they could never be accused or, through accident, have something happen that would result in a catastrophe. And the situation was terribly tense. And again, I emphasize all these armchair critics now who look back and say, everybody overreacted. I only wish they could have been on duty with some of those troops when certain things happened, and I'll relate one or two little anecdotes. Been there. And say now what they're saying. I'm sure that they would have had an entirely different song to sing if they had been present. Yeah. Well, the troops, we kept the tasks kept growing. Power lines had to be protected. The main source of power coming into Montreal, the great fear that they would only got to do is knock down a couple of those towers. Carrying all those high voltage wires and cables, and Montreal would be in the dark. So towers had to be protected. The lines, actually, we had to put helicopters patrolling the lines once you get a little bit way out, just to make sure that there wasn't anybody moving around. The bridges had to be protected, and then we got down to the protection of individuals. And of course, you'll recall there were stories of cabinet ministers having guards outside their houses, all sorts of things. Now, it was even extended to the senior officers. For example, we all had to carry small sidearms. All senior officers had to carry small sidearms. But we didn't carry the usual military holster and revolver, the issue stuff, because it would be too obvious that here we were all wandering around with sidearms on. And again, every attempt was being made not to show concern openly if it could be avoided. And so it was decided that we were to carry arms, but it would be little Browning automatics, little 30.30 Browning automatics, and we all had to go over the range and learn how to handle these weapons. And by God, that little Browning 30 is a automatic is a vicious little weapon, a vicious little weapon, and it's only meant for close in work. There's no sighting on it. It's shooting from the hip kind of stuff. And it was such a small weapon that you could actually put it in a holster and wear the holster on your belt in the green uniform, and it wouldn't show underneath the flap of the tunic. And you could wear it just sort of. Almost in the groin, so to speak, and never see it. And we were all carrying one of the panic procurements, and there were several panic procurements, was a bunch of Browning automatics for the senior officers. That was one thing. as the threats became more serious, and after the Laporte kidnapping, all the seniors had to travel with an armed driver and a shotgun rider as well in the front seat, who again would be sitting there, but with an automatic weapon, but not so it could be seen as you were driving along. And it became even worse. We had threats of bombs being planted in houses. All sorts of threats were coming from the FLQ, all in these billydoos. Well, not knowing where, of course they would never say where the heck they were planting these bombs, but the kind of thing that was happening was all of a sudden, unbeknownst to me, twice this happened, bomb disposal squads arrived at our house in Westmount. And Barbara, and we had a maid at that time, and one time David was home from school, or ordered right out of the house, bingo, just right out of the house. And the house gone over from stem to gudgeon, looking for explosives.
Yeah.
Well, again, you can imagine the reaction on a wife who suddenly has a troop arrive at the front door and say, sorry, we've got to leave the house, we have a bomb threat.
Yeah.
And then go over the whole place. Now, twice that happened. Now, this is a bit disconcerting.
Yeah.
Because, again, with the tension that was there, and the wife, no warning, all of a sudden, bingo, they arrive and go over the place. That, again. And then finally, David, who was then about six, because he was going to school, he'd be about 6 years old, literally having to be taken to school in a staff car with an armed escort for fear of kidnapping. It went that far down the line.
Yeah.
Behind us, on where we lived in Westmount, there was a consul general living, just literally on the next street. Our back fences sort of abutted. He had, there were at least three or four people on guard on duty outside his place all the time as a result of the cross kidnapping, for fear that some other consul general or diplomat would be kidnapped and held up for whatever ransom they wanted. So the demand for manpower just grew and grew and grew, and this is 24-hour stuff. This is not a shift of 8 hours. So it called for a lot of organization. We kept pulling in regiments, until literally we had nothing left in Canada. And I have said, and we used to say at our ops room briefings, we only said it once, but it was enough, and everyone knew, God, please don't let there be another emergency anywhere in Canada. Now at that time, and concurrent with that, there was a strike in Vancouver. Now what was it? Was it a dock strike or a police strike? There was something here on the West Coast that looked nasty. And we watched it like a hawk from Mobile Command, because we thought, if that gets out of control, what do we throw into the breach? And we literally had reached the point where we would have had to go to the government and say, call out the militia, as about the only thing that we had left.
Yeah.
So we had no reserves left other than the militia or calling out. Now, we did have some Air Force call out, but I suppose we could have stripped some of the stations of manpower if we'd had to. But that would have meant a complete cessation of all military operations in that sense. Or we could have called out some of the Navy, which would have meant keeping the ships in dock and so forth alongside. There was that, but that was the only regular force reserve that was left. And we were worried stiff about that. Very, very few Air Force people had ever been trained to use a weapon, and similarly the Navy. So that we would have had troops, if we'd ever had to put a gun in their hands, who would not have had any experience with it. So right away, quick, you get back to the situation of a group of men, they may be disciplined, but never having been trained in this type of thing, whereas our regular force army had, of course, had lots of training in this field, in this sense. And the chance of something going wrong and somebody being shot could have happened so easily that it was frightening. Well, the decision was made, of course, to hope and pray that nothing helped. And we managed to cope, meet the manpower requirement with the regular force, the regiments, the recce units, everything came in. And we were getting, we now had, several weeks had gone by, and these troops had been on duty 7 days a week, working long hours, sort of 12-hour shifts. Yeah. And it was a question of, you know, we had to start breaking this up somehow, giving these troops some kind of a break. Because if we didn't, then all we were doing was looking for fatigue. And fatigue leads to somebody forgetting discipline or reacting to a situation, and bingo, again, trouble. So, and not only that, the requirement for the troops was literally all over the city of Montreal and the immediate environs of Montreal. So you had to have communications with all of these places, these little places, in case something happened. They had to be able to call in immediately, so call for a hell of a big radio net, frequencies. We had to have the vehicles to move people back and forth. These people had to be fed. Rations had to be gotten to them, or they had to be brought into a central kitchen, not a central kitchen, dispersed kitchens, because what happened was kitchens were set up all in all the armories, any place or rented hall where we could, and the troops had to be relieved, brought in for a meal, and then back out again. It called for a fairly detailed organization to tie this whole thing together and do it quickly, which is what Chouinard and his staff did, and I have the highest respect for Chouinard. He did an absolutely magnificent job as the operational commander of all the forces that were involved in this thing. He did it beautifully. There were times when he came in to our morning briefings when you could see that he was just beside himself with anger at the lack of action or the lack of information or running into opposition in terms of cooperation, whatever it might be. And yet he always kept his cool. He was a very, very fine field commander, in the real sense of the word. Yeah. I've said to myself many times, you know, if I ever had to go to war, I wouldn't mind going out with Chouinard. He's a very cool customer and knew his business. That was the other half. He knew his business. He knew exactly what to do. And thank God we had a man like that. I'm not saying that others wouldn't have been as good, but certainly the man that was picked sure did the job par excellence. He was superb. Well, let's see, what else can I give you in the way of background on the organization? I think I've pretty well covered it. We had... Go ahead. Yeah.
You mentioned about bringing in regiments from all over Canada. These would be under canvas at the time?
Yes. Or? No. Well, what we did was we took over the armories, all the armories. We had... of course, St. Hubert could take more than we had, because we'd clear the hangars, for example.
Yeah.
And the troops were literally on the concrete floor, just one, two, three, four, just literally side by side. Very difficult for the troops. Ablutions were a big problem. You suddenly move 1,000 troops into hangars at St. Hubert, and the hangars just have normal... That's right, exactly. They're meant for a maximum of 100 people working in the hangar. There was the other base in North Montreal. The base. It's gone for a bit. It also has been used to bring them. Used when we brought large numbers of refugees in, and they would put them into this camp and run them. It was set up. It had capacity for a lot of troops. I can't remember the number.
Wasn't there at this time? A certain, either it was a scare or it was actually being done about weapons being swiped from armories?
Oh, yes, quite right. Yes, absolutely correct. That was, again, the type of incident that was happening. There was a break-in on one of the militia, one of the armories, and a certain number of weapons were stolen.
Yeah.
Fortunately, the bolts were all locked up in the safe, so they didn't get away with the bolts. But, which was fine, except that bolts, it would only take a break-in to some other place and get the bolts from, say, a gunsmith shop or something like this, get the right kind of bolts, and those guns were effective. You're absolutely right. There were several incidents. There was another one of some dynamite being stolen from a construction company. And, of course, all these incidents were reported into the central ops room. In the Quebec Provincial Police Headquarters, so that again, the thing didn't stop. There was always something happening. And hardly a day went by that there wasn't an incident which could only be interpreted as an increasing degree of threat of some form.
Was anybody being rounded up at this time?
Well, yeah. Oh, yes. Well, now here again, one of the reasons why the military were called in, one of many reasons, was that the police, the RCMP, the provincial police, had dossiers, I suppose, on all kinds of people who were suspect for whatever reason. Criminals, leftists, people who had somehow or other run afoul of the law, and who therefore might have been considered to be a part of the FLQ. But it was going to take, once the War Measures Act was declared, it was going to take a lot of police to round these people up and bring them in. As you know, the War Measures Act, you can incarcerate somebody for 30 days without so much as buy your leave or bringing them before a judge or anything like that. But it would take a lot of police. So the police had to be relieved of all the duties that they were doing, which were literally almost handling traffic, if I can put it that way, to go and do this other job of rounding up people. The military, we played little or no part in that. The only time I think we did play a part was when we had an arrangement that in a police car there would be a soldier who would go with the policeman. Now, the reason for that was that purely and simply to spread the police, who were the official people, more. In other words, instead of having two to a car, which would have meant fewer cars, there was one to a car plus a soldier. And in the event, the soldier would just be there. It was moral support. And if the policeman got out of his car and there was something going on, let's say a small rat started, whatever it might be, and he was the first one on the spot, he would get out of the car, but he was the one who would have to take the action with a mob or arrest the leader or whatever it might be. But there would be this soldier with an automatic weapon standing behind him. And it was psychological. Purely psychological.
But it would help.
Very much so. Because, again, there was a question of under what conditions would the soldier actually shoot. It was psychological. So, I didn't mention the rounding up of people because it was really handled by the police. And then they were all taken down to the provincial police building, which is a big building in Montreal. And there they were questioned, interrogated, and many, 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 of course, were not retained. Yeah. But on the other hand, there were a lot who were thrown in the jug. I have no idea why or how or under what conditions they were retained. I wouldn't be at all surprised that the police pulled in some people who'd been giving them a hard time and probably gave them a big lip when they were being interrogated. And the police sort of saying, all right. If that's the way you feel about it, in the bloody jug. Rather, perhaps on that basis, perhaps as much as anything else. But
you also mentioned, Reg, one or two incidents.
Oh, yes, I'll get to those in a second, yeah.
Yeah.
I want to also mention that when we were talking about the troops and the distribution of troops, just the logistic support of these troops was a bit of a problem, too. They had to be fed and getting the rations in and so forth. There was a lot of procurement that were required all of a sudden. I mentioned the guns, the automatics that we had. There were a lot of other things that were required, which were not more of a basic military requirement, bits and pieces. Buying rations from off the local economy and so forth was quite a change from normal ration depot forwarding on a scale basis, on a daily issue basis. It was all quite different. And so there was a lot of extemporization, a lot of initiative on a daily basis to meet the changed conditions. But it was a big task, so we had a logistic support requirement as well as the actual bayonets themselves. Yes, there were several incidents that occurred. One that I love to tell, and one that to me is indicative of the type of discipline and the importance of discipline. When you have a situation such as this crisis, one of the places being guarded was one of the local police stations, and we had some troops. And normally, there was in the smaller police stations in the suburbs, there was one armed soldier on duty, sort of outside, just literally patrolling. So he could be seen. Mm-hmm. So he was there. Again, the psychological effect of there, because some of the police stations had been attacked by God knows who. Again, we didn't know who was doing all this. We didn't know that it was all coordinated. We found out afterwards that these were all absolutely disconnected incidents. They were not controlled from one center of one man running the whole thing. But everything seemed to be fitting in so well that we had to think and we had to work on the assumption that it was being controlled by a very capable operations group, such as I mentioned, as somebody come in from the outside. Because and so police stations had to be guarded. One police station was almost burned down through a firebomb, a passing vehicle and a firebomb going in. Well, this boy was from the Van Dues. And of course the boys were there in their battle dress, and they were wearing their various flashes, shoulder flashes and so forth. So there was no question about who they were. And a character, a hippie, I suppose, is the best way to describe him, came up to one of the young Van Dues who was on duty and castigated him about being disloyal to Quebec, that he was a traitor, and gave him a stream of vitriolic abuse, including his parentage and everything else. And this lad just stood there and took it all. Until finally, this hippie, obviously realizing he wasn't getting anywhere with him, just having no impact on this young lad at all, spat in his face. And with that, this young lad just very quickly, but as he had been trained, brought his butt up and hit this character in the jaw and shattered his jaw. Well, and with that, of course, the police came out. They had heard this character, but thought, oh, well, it's usual. But then they realized that something happened, and they came up. And this young Frenchman said to the police, I'm afraid this character, whatever word he used, just ran into my rifle butt. And I'm afraid he's injured. So when that, the police picked him up and took him inside and said, I agree. That's terrible. We will look after him from here on. And with that, the lad went back to, back to his guard duty, just as if nothing had happened. But it was the reaction of the lad that he took it until finally he felt that this was now a little bit of self-defense is in order. But it was only a question of doing what he'd been trained, and he belted this character hard enough, as I say, to break his jaw. That character didn't do any talking for some few days after that, with everything wired together. But I'm trying to remember a couple of others, of little anecdotes, little things. And we got these things in the ops room, because Chouinard would get them from the various commanders who reported these things. They had to be reported where there had been a confrontation, so that we were advised, and if the press got onto them, then we would be already immediately with the story of what actually happened from the military side, not some biased reporter talking about the cruelty of the troops and attacking innocent citizens and so forth. We had to be ready for all these. So whenever there was a confrontation, immediately we were advised of it with the story, and of course our daily meetings and all the time. The PR shop in the organization, which also had to be built up, were ready constantly and on every briefing, listening to everything that was going on, so they could respond if the press got onto something and it became a political issue or whatever, just to compound the situation, which was already political enough as it was.
Yeah.
But those sort of things were happening all over the city. And when it was over, it was with the greatest respect that I look back now, and I did it then, on the troops that we had in Mobile Command. If there was ever an occasion when there could have been something go wrong as a result of one person not being responsive to orders or not listening to orders or deciding to act on his own, that was it. And we had not one single incident. And in that whole time period of some 3 months, that and I think it is indicative of just the standard that existed in the Canadian troops and their training. It was superb. Now, as it went downstream, of course, it began to get cold. We now got to try to get into October. And October and November in Montreal, it gets damn cold. Now, the troops had all come out at the end of the summer, so that they were literally in their summer gear. Well, now we had to go through the business of bringing all their damn winter gear in. And we weren't any too quick off the mark on that one, because I can remember watching a couple of, or seeing a couple of lads in their field gear, battle dress, field gear, combat gear, summer combat gear, which is quite thin. Mm. Boy, just on duty and literally shivering like hell. They were bloody cold at night because the temperatures were dropping. Yeah. And we perhaps were a little remiss. Not, we, of course, hoped that things would recover.
Yeah.
Because after Laporte was found, the Billydoos began to drop off. Not immediately, but there were incidents after that. But they became less frequent.
Mm-hmm.
And we reached the point where we were going for days and days and days, almost weeks now, without something happening. And by this time, the government, and this is perhaps not a fair judgment, but at least it was the way I felt, the Quebec government seemed to have regained their confidence. They seemed to have feel that they had things back under control. Yeah. The discussions with Choquette would indicate that he reached the point where he was saying, "Well, now, much longer do you think we should carry on this way? When should we get things back to normal?" So it went on until I'm sorry, we still haven't, of course, recovered Cross. He's still. And that. The locating of Cross was really a magnificent piece of work. It was the old business of, I suppose, just footwork, police footwork. The police, I suppose, almost covered Montreal by foot. They all, of course, with the War Measures Act, they could walk in, warrants and so forth were neither here nor there, and they would just walk into a place, all done very politely and very smoothly. Sorry, we must carry out a search. And they would go through the houses, and they went through thousands and thousands of houses. And it was as a result of all this constant search and surveillance that they finally located the building or the house that Cross was in. And we knew about it, of course, at Mobile Command, and so we wanted, I thought, well, I'll get in the chopper and go and have a look. And I went in the chopper and flew over the house at a fairly low altitude. Nothing going on, although we could see the police now, RCMP. They had began to put some police around the area.
Mm-hmm.
And while the Council of War was held about how do we get this man out?
Mm-hmm.
Do we rush it? Do we blow the place up? What is the next step? And then it was decided that there would be an intermediary who would go in and try and bargain, which, of course, was what happened.
Yeah.
But, of course, the troops were moved in. The whole area was literally roped off, and people were moved out of the houses in the immediate area just in case a shooting war started, and there was no reason to suppose that it wouldn't be a shooting war. And I guess, then, of course, the agreement was made that those particular members of the FLQ would be flown to Cuba, and they would be taken to the airport, and then flown out. Well, when that happened, I was in a chopper, and I was sitting over the house when that broken down old Buick or whatever it was they had in the garage was backed out and hit the side of the damn driveway, and then drove at breakneck speed. God, traveling through Montreal the way they did.
This was the FLQ people under escort?
Under escort.
Yeah.
Under escort. Gee, they must have gone through Montreal at 70 miles an hour, and I don't give a damn. Well, I don't know what it is about escort people, but they always seem to take great joy in driving at the limit of the vehicle that they're in. I've done it in Paris and just been petrified at the end of it. I did it once in Montreal with Rockingham, with a police escort, and was petrified at the bloody end of it, even though you know you're under complete escort and police on every corner kind of thing, but oh, Jesus, you only could take that one car to come out, or the driver to hit some ice or whatever it might be, and yeah. whammo. Anyway, I just don't enjoy that kind of thing. And I felt for those people who were in those vehicles, because they went from, what was it, North Montreal, all the way out to the, where the
Mirabelle?
The exhibition had been,
World
Fair,
yeah.
where the discussions and where the trade took place.
Yeah.
And then they were flown, then they were taken by another escort, the FLQ people, out to Dorval, and then on to a Yukon, and then flown aircraft from Transport Command, and then flown to Cuba. But that ride, I followed them when we were in the chopper, and that damn ride, I sat there saying, I wonder if they're just going to make it. They literally, speed was unbelievable. However, they did. And then the exchange took place, and the aircraft took off. Well, after that, it was when things began to quieten down.
Yeah.
And we still didn't know that there we weren't sure how many cells there were. But I guess it was about that time that we began to realize that we were not dealing with large numbers. Because we began to get, or we had received billy-doos from so-called the such-and-such cell of the FLQ. The such-and-such cell. And it would began to show that they were not coordinated, that they were operating independently.
Yeah.
So immediately we began to appreciate that we were not dealing with a large, coordinated group who were determined to bring about the downfall of the government.
Mm-hmm.
That this was political, yes, but in a restricted sense, not wide open. But it took it was a long, long time before we were able to come to that mm-hmm. conclusion. And once that cell was picked up, then, and they moved, they left the country, then right away, quick, things quietened down. They still hadn't picked up the people who had done the Laporte murder,
mm-hmm.
although, of course, the police were working again day and night trying to solve that murder. And Choquette, and discussions said, now, how much longer do you think we should go on? And we, by this time, had felt that and reached the conclusion that it was not as large a resurrection as had appeared initially. That, and so we said, okay, let's start backing off. So began to bring in the troops from the less important vital points. The bodyguards began to be pulled in from the lesser lights. And so gradually we were able to release units. And so units. And the Vandoos were the last to leave because, of course, they were the French-speaking unit. Yeah. They were the last to leave. And they began to pick up the duties of, say, that had been undertaken by the PPCLI from Winnipeg. And they began to pick up their, if they had had an one of the higher priority tasks. Mm. And so gradually we pulled in. Until finally, even the Vandoos were allowed to go home. But it was a very gradual rundown. It wasn't just one day they were all there, and then the next day they all went home.
Yeah.
It was stretched out over quite a long period of time. And as I say, by that time, the government had regained its confidence. I think they had, of course, through their own organization and through the discussions which were going on in this joint ops room, had reached the conclusion, as we had, that this was not a large, organized attempt to bring about the downfall of the government. That it was a number, still numbers unknown, a number of dedicated to a cause people who were determined at whatever cost to bring about or to gain acceptance, political acceptance of one form or another. And that was what we were fighting. But that's hindsight, and we didn't know that at the time. Well, as a result, the thing quietly died out. The Laporte kidnappers were ultimately found. That cell who had cross, they went to Cuba. That was it. But it's fascinating that here we are talking about this, and in this past week or so, those people have come back, have finally come back after, what, some 10 years?
Yeah.
8 years, is it? And I look back on it as being a very, very interesting period in our history for several reasons. One, it shows just what can be accomplished by a small group if they are determined to go to any length to achieve whatever the objective is that they're after. I don't think these people really had a clear objective of what they wanted. I think it was rather vague. As a matter of fact, the manifesto which they issued was rather a vague thing. It's full of a lot of diatribe about politics and so forth, but no real basic political platform that one could say, oh yes, that makes sense, or it doesn't make sense. Yeah. It was very difficult to even grasp the intent of the manifesto. But nevertheless, it did, as I say, show what a small group could do,
yeah,
if they're determined and they're organized enough to literally disrupt a whole province.
Yeah.
Second thing is, it did bring out the fact that the training that had been done in riot control as aid to the civil power, what's that aid to the civil power, which had been in the books and our statutes for years and years and years, was suddenly brought out and dusted off as a possibility. That the training that had taken place in riot control and how to cope with the this sort of a situation, not that situation specifically, but in a general sense, from a military training point of view, just how good, and thank God we had done that training. I had attended various exercises in Mobile Command where one unit would be the rioters and the other route would be the other group organization would be the military force. And some of those things, those damn exercises, were realistic as hell. And I mean realistic, even to the point of throwing paint on the troops and so forth. And diabolical. I think the lads who were the units who were put in civilian clothes to be the civilians really sat down and said, now just how nasty can we get? What can we do? In an attempt to get the troops in uniform to break down, to do something that would break discipline. And some of the stuff I was done was bloody rough. I could see one time I was with a commander and he almost went white because he didn't really think that the opposition were going to do quite what they did. In other words, they were writing their own rules and he didn't like it.
Yeah.
It was getting a bit too rough. But it was all excellent training, and I'm sure everyone else would feel the same way, that thank God we had troops who had been trained this way, because the discipline of the troops was superb. I suppose the third thing, and perhaps of more greater importance than anything else, it made the government realize, probably for the first time, that here in Canada it is possible.
Yeah, it can happen here.
To have a situation that can get out of control of a political nature, an internal nature, and that there is really only one recourse when the situation gets out of control, and that is the military. And the military had better be well trained to prevent something like civil war.
And of sufficient size.
Yeah. The numbers.
Yeah. I've often said myself that if it hadn't been for the FLQ crisis, you'd just have a troop of Boy Scouts today. I think that's one thing that taught the Prime Minister.
Historically, I suppose it will show that the Prime Minister began to change his opinion, his philosophy, his approach to the military, the need for military forces. It changed, or that was the beginning of the change, when he saw how well the troops had handled that FLQ crisis and prevented a very, very serious situation. One can write all kinds of scenarios, you know, Reg, in this. If the troops had not been so good, it is possible that the provincial government might have collapsed. And just think of what that impact that would have had in the country if the provincial government had come apart and a rump government had been formed of some of the concerned civilian leaders.
Forming
their own government. I'd be more concerned about forming their own government, taking over. That would be a coup d'etat, in a sense. And what would that have done to our democracy in Canada if that had occurred? So you can sit back and think of all sorts of things that might have happened which would have had a disastrous impact in the longer haul in Canada.
Yeah.
And it was the troops who prevented that from happening. And I don't think many people realize that much, and particularly those people who have criticized it. the government for declaring the War Measures Act. Sure, in retrospect, you can look and say that, as the good book says, insurrection, real or apprehended. And in this case, it was apprehended. God, the people who have to make those decisions have got a terrible choice to make. And I would, I think, be inclined, and I'm sure these people who criticize would do the same thing in the same position, would tend to make their decision lean towards the safe side rather than the chance side. And by declaring the War Measures Act, sure, it was a big weapon, but it was the only weapon that the government had make. And also, the critics talk about the War Measures Act being too big a club. But they forget that legislatively and on our books, there is no half measure. It is the normal situation or the War Measures Act. And the government had no choice. If they were going to take some positive action, they had no choice to declare, but to declare the War Measures Act, because there was nothing else they could declare. And that is why there has been talk about introducing, and the government has talked ever since, about introducing legislation which would be halfway to the War Measures Act. That's something that they could invoke, which would not necessarily take away all the rights of citizens, which is what the War Measures Act does. The War Measures Act is rough stuff.
I know.
Terribly rough. Yeah. But people don't realize or forget that the government, that was the only recourse the government had, the only legislation they had. There was nothing else they could do. There was no time to rush through the House an act which would give restrictive measures.
No,
it just wasn't time. They had to make a move. It was either declare the War Measures Act or not. I think they made the right decision. I'm sure they made the right decision. Without it, I'm not too sure just what rioting or what control might have happened. Again, you can write a scenario, all kinds of them, if they had not done so-and-so. But perhaps what is needed, and the big lesson, and I don't know why the government has been so slow in introducing legislation. Maybe they think it'll never happen again. Good old Canadian approach to life. It'll can't happen here. Maybe, I don't know, I can't understand why they have been so slow in writing legislation, something short of the War Measures Act. I say that very quickly. Yeah. It might be extremely difficult, and if not, impractical. I don't know. Where do you draw the line? In terms of all that is in the War Measures Act, or in rewriting a new act, what would you drop from the War Measures Act?
Yeah.
And perhaps every one of them is absolutely essential in that kind of a situation. And maybe the War Measures Act is the right approach.
I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think what I'll do, Reg, I'm going to go through this again and with a little pad and pencil with me and perhaps ask you some questions on it in the next batch.
Sure. Yep.
Good.
You bet. Rioting or what control might have happened. Again, you can write a scenario, all kinds of them, if they had not done so-and-so. But perhaps what is needed, and the big lesson, and I don't know why the government has been so slow in introducing legislation, maybe they think it'll never happen again. Good old Canadian approach to life. It'll can't happen here. Maybe, I don't know, I can't understand why they have been so slow in writing legislation, something short of the War Measures Act. I say that very quickly.
Yeah.
It might be extremely difficult, and if not, impractical. I don't know. Where do you draw the line in terms of all that is in the War Measures Act? Or in rewriting a new act, what would you drop from the War Measures Act?
Yeah.
And perhaps every one of them is absolutely essential in that kind of a situation. And maybe the War Measures Act is the right approach.
I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think what I'll do... Reg, I'm going to go through this again and with a little pad and pencil with me and perhaps ask you some questions on it in the next batch.
Yep. Good. You bet.